Catlin would make a new son together when he returned. They were not so old yet, and of late he had often found himself dreaming of snow, of the deep quiet of the Wolf's Wood at night. And yet the thought of leaving angered him as well. So much was still undone. Robert and his council of cravens and flatterers would beggar the realm if left unchecked, or worse, sell it to the Lannisters in payment of their loans. And the truth of John Aaron's death still eluded him. Oh, he had found a few pieces, enough to convince himself that John had indeed been murdered, but that was no more than the spoor of an animal on the forest floor. He had not sighted the beast itself, though he sensed it was there, lurking, hidden, treacherous. It struck him suddenly that he might return to Winterfell by sea. Ned was no sailor, and ordinarily he would have preferred the King's Road, but if he took a ship, he could stop at Dragonstone and speak with Stannis Baratheon. Pycelle had sent a raven off across the water with a polite letter from Ned requesting Lord Stannis to return to his seat on the small council. As yet there had been no reply, but the silence only deepened his suspicions. Lord Stannis shared the secret John Aaron had died for. He was certain of it. The truth, he sought, might well be waiting for him on the ancient island fortress of House Targaryen. And when you have it, what then? Some secrets are safer kept hidden. Some secrets are too dangerous to share, even with those you love and trust. Ned slid the dagger that Catelyn had brought him out of the sheath on his belt. The imp's knife. Why would the dwarf want Bran dead? To silence him, surely. Another secret. Or only a different strand of the same web. Could Robert be part of it? He would not have thought so, but once he would not have thought Robert could command the murder of women and children either. Catelyn had tried to warn him. You knew the man, she had said. The king is a stranger to you. The sooner he was quit of King's Landing, the better. If there was a ship sailing north on the morrow, it would be well to be on it. He summoned Vaen Poole again, and sent him to the dock to make inquiries, quietly but quickly. "Find me a fast ship with a skilled captain," he told the steward. "I care nothing for the size of its cabins or the quality of its appointments, so long as it is swift and safe. I wish to leave at once." Poole had no sooner taken his leave than Tomard announced a visitor. "Lord Baelish to see you, my lord." Ned was half tempted to turn him away, but thought better of it. He was not free yet. Until he was, he must play their games. "Show him in, Tom." Lord Petyr sauntered into the solar as if nothing had gone amiss that morning. He wore a slashed velvet doublet in cream and silver, a grey silk cloak trimmed with black fox, and his customary mocking smile. Ned greeted him coldly. "Might I ask the reason for this visit, Lord Baelish?" "I won't detain you long. I'm on my way to dine with Lady Tender. Lamprey pie and roast suckling pig. She has some thought to wed me to her younger daughter, so her table is always astonishing. If truth be told, I'd sooner marry the pig. But don't tell her. I do love lamprey pie." "Don't let me keep you from your eels, my lord," Ned said with icy disdain. "At the moment I cannot think of anyone whose company I desire less than yours." "Oh, I'm certain if you put your mind to it you could come up with a few names. Varys, say, Cersei, or Robert. His Grace is most wroth with you. He went on about you at some length after you took your leave of us this morning. The words insolence and ingratitude came into it frequently, I seem to recall." Ned did not honour that with a reply, nor did he offer his guest a seat, but Littlefinger took one anyway. "After you'd stormed out, it was left to me to convince them not to hire the faceless men," he continued blithely. "Instead, Varys will quietly let it be known that will make a lord of whoever does in the Targaryen girl. Ned was disgusted. So, now we grant titles to assassins. Littlefinger shrugged. Titles are cheap. The faceless men are expensive. If truth be told, I did the Targaryen girl more good than you, with all your talk of honour. Let some sellsword, drunk on visions of lordship, try to kill her. Likely he'll make a butch of it, and afterwards the Dothraki will be on their guard. If we send a faceless man after her, she'll be as good as buried. Ned frowned. You sit in council and talk of ugly women and steal kisses, and now you expect me to believe that you tried to protect the girl? How big a fool do you take me for? Well, quite an enormous one, actually, said Littlefinger, laughing. Do you always find murder so amusing, Lord Baelish? It's not murder I find amusing, Lord Stark, it's you. You rule like a man dancing on rotten ice. I dare say you will make a noble splash. I believe I heard the first crack this morning. The first and last, said Ned. I've had my fill. When do you mean to return to Winterfell, my lord? As soon as I can. What concern is that of yours? None. But if perchance you're still here come evenfall, I'd be pleased to take you to this brothel your man Jory has been searching for so ineffectually. Littlefinger smiled. And I won't even tell Lady Catelyn.
Jamie. The trumpets made a brazen blare and cut the still blue air of dusk. Josmin Peckledon was on his feet at once, scrambling for his master's sword belt. The boy has good instincts. Outlaws don't blow trumpets to herald their arrival, Jamie told him. I shan't need my sword. That will be my cousin, the Warden of the West. The riders were dismounting when he emerged from his tent. Half a dozen knights and 20 mounted archers and men-at-arms. Jamie! Roared a shaggy man clad in gilded ringmail and a fox fur cloak. So gaunt and all in white. And bearded, too. This? Mere stubble against that mane of yours, cuz. Sir Davin's bristling beard and bushy mustache grew into side whiskers as thick as a hedgerow, and those into the tangled yellow thicket atop his head, matted down by the helm he was removing. Somewhere in the midst of all that hair lurked a pug nose and a pair of lively hazel eyes. Did some outlaw steal your razor? I vowed I would not let my hair be cut until my father was avenged. For a man who looked so leonine, Davin Lannister sounded oddly sheepish. The young wolf got to Karstark first, though. Robbed me of my vengeance. He handed his helm to a squire and pushed his fingers through his hair, where the weight of the steel had crushed it down. I like a bit of hair. The nights grow colder and a little foliage helps to keep your face warm. Aye, and Aunt Jenna always said I had a brick for a chin. He clasped Jamie by the arms. We feared for you after the Whispering Wood. Heard Stark's direwolf tore out your throat. Did you weep bitter tears for me, cuz? Half of Lannisport was mourning. The female half. Sir Davin's gaze went to Jamie's stump. So it's true. The bastards took your sword hand. I have a new one, made of gold. There's much to be said for being one-handed. I drink less wine for fear of spilling, and am seldom inclined to scratch my arse at court. Aye, there's that. Maybe I should have mine off as well. His cousin laughed. Was it Catelyn Stark who took it? Vargo Hote. Where do these tales come from? The Cohoric, Sir Davin spat. That's for him and all his brave companions. I told your father I would forage for him, but he refused me. Some tasks are fit for lions, he said, but foraging is best left for goats and dogs. Lord Tywin's very words, Jamie knew. He could almost hear his father's voice. Come inside, cuz. We need to talk. Garrett had lit the braziers, and their glowing coals filled Jamie's tent with a ruddy heat. Sir Davin shrugged out of his cloak and tossed it at little Lou. You a piper, boy, he growled. You have a runty look, dear. I'm Lewis Piper, if it please, my lord. I beat your brother bloody in a melee once. The runty little fool took offense when I asked him if that was his sister dancing naked on his shield. She's the sigil of our house. We don't have a sister. More's the pity. Your sigil has nice teats. What sort of man hides behind a naked woman, though? Every time I thumped your brother's shield, I felt unchivalrous. Enough, said Jamie, laughing. Leave him be. Pia was mulling wine for them, stirring the kettle with a spoon. I need to know what I can expect to find at River Run. His cousin shrugged. The siege drags on. The Blackfish sits inside the castle. We sit outside in our camps. Bloody boring if you want the truth. Sir Davin seated himself upon a camp stool. Tully ought to make a sortie to remind us all we're still at war. Be nice if he culled some frays, too. Ryman, for a start. The man's drunk more often than not. Oh, and Edwin, not as thick as his father, but as full of hate as a boil's full of pus. And our own Sir Emmon. No, Lord Emmon. Seven save us. Must not forget his new title. Our Lord of River Run does naught but try to tell me how to run the siege. He wants me to take the castle without damaging it, since it is now his lordly seat. Is that wine hot yet? Jamie asked Pierre.
Yes, my lord.
The girl covered her mouth when she spoke. Peck served the wine on a golden platter. Sir Davin pulled off his gloves and took a cup. Thank you, boy. Who might you be?
Josmin Peckleton, if it please my lord.
Peck was a hero on the Blackwater, Jamie said. He slew two knights and captured two more. You must be more dangerous than you look, lad. Is that a beard, or did you forget to wash the dirt off your face? Stannis Baratheon's wife has a thicker mustache. How old are you?
15, sir.
Sir Davin snorted. You know the best thing about heroes, Jamie? They all die young and leave more women for the rest of us. He tossed the cup back to the squire. Fill that full again and I'll call you hero too. I have a thirst. Jamie lifted his own cup left-handed and took a swallow. The warmth spread through his chest. You were speaking of the phrase you wanted dead. Ryman, Edwin, Emmon, and Walder Rivers, Davin said. That horse, son. Hates that he's a bastard and hates everyone who's not. Sir Perwin seems a decent fellow, though. Might as well spare him. The women, too. I'm to marry one, I hear. Your father might have seen fit to consult with me about this marriage, by the by. My own father was treating with Paxter red wine before Oxcross, did you know? Red wine has a nicely dowered daughter. Desmera, Jamie laughed. How well do you like freckles? If my choice is Fraser or freckles, well, half of Lord Walder's brood look like stoats. Only half, be thankful. I saw Lancel's bride at Derry. Gatehouse Army, gods be good. I couldn't believe that Lancel picked that one. What's wrong with that boy? He's grown pious, said Jamie. But it wasn't him who did the picking. Lady Amory's mother is a Derry. Our uncle thought she'd help Lancel win the Derry small folk. Oh, by fucking them. You know why they call her Gatehouse Army? She raises her portcullis for every knight who happens by. Lancel had best find an armourer to make him a horned helm. That won't be necessary. Our cuz is off to King's Landing to take vows as one of the High Septon's swords. Sir Davin could not have looked more astonished if Jamie had told him that Lancel had decided to become a mummer's monkey. Not truly. You are japing with me. Gatehouse Army must be more stoutish than I'd heard if she could drive the boy to that. When Jamie had taken his leave of Lady Amory, she had been weeping softly at the dissolution of her marriage, whilst letting Lyle Crakehall console her. Her tears had not troubled him half so much as the hard looks on the face of her kin as they stood about the yard. "I hope you do not intend to take vows as well, Cas," he said to Davin. "The phrase are prickly where marriage contracts are concerned. I would hate to disappoint them again." Sir Davin snorted. "I'll wed and bed my stoat, never fear. I know what happened to Rob Stark. From what Edwin tells me, though, I'd best pick one who hasn't flowered yet, or I'm like to find that Black Walder has been there first. I'll wager he's had Gatehouse Army, and more than thrice. Maybe that explains Lancel's godliness and his father's mood. You have seen Sir Kevin? Aye, he passed here on his way west. I asked him to help us take the castle, but Kevin would have none of it. He brooded the whole time he was here. Courteous enough, but chilly. I swore to him that I never asked to be made Warden of the West, that the honour should have gone to him, and he declared that he held no grudge against me. But you would never have known it from his tone. He stayed 3 days and hardly said 3 words to me. Would that he'd remained. I could have used his counsel. Our friends of Frey would not have dared vex Sir Kevin the way they've been vexing me. Tell me, said Jamie. I would, but where to begin? Whilst I've been building rams and siege towers, Ryman Frey has raised a gibbet. Every day at dawn he brings forth Edmure Tully, drapes a noose around his neck, and threatens to hang him unless the castle yields. The blackfish pays his mummer's show no mind, so come evenfall, Lord Edmure is taken down again. His wife's with child, did you know? He hadn't. Edmure bedded her after the Red Wedding. He was bedding her during the Red Wedding. Rosalind's a pretty little thing, hardly stoutish at all, and fond of Edmure, queerly. Perwin tells me she's praying for a girl. Jamie considered that for a moment. Once Edmure's son is born, Lord Walder will have no more need of Edmure. That's how I see it, too. Our good Uncle Em, Lord Emmon, that is, he wants Edmure hanged at once. The presence of a Tully, Lord of Riverrun, distresses him almost as much as the prospective birth of yet another. Daily he beseeches me to make Sir Ryman dangle Tully, never mind how. Meanwhile I have Lord Gawain Westerling tugging at my other sleeve. The Blackfish has his lady wife inside the castle, along with 3 of his snot-nosed whelps. His lordship fears Tully will kill them if the Freys hang Edmure. One of them is the young wolf's little queen. Jamie had met Jane Westerling, he thought, though he could not recall what she looked like. She must be fair indeed to have been worth a kingdom. Sir Brendan won't kill children, he assured his cousin. He's not as black a fish as that. He was beginning to grasp why Riverrun had not yet fallen. Tell me of your dispositions, cuz. We have the castle well encircled. Sir Ryman and the Freys are north of the Tumblestone. South of Red Fork sits Lord Emmon, with Sir Forley Prester, and with what remains of your old host, plus the river lords who come over to us after the Red Wedding. A sullen lot, I don't mind saying. Good for sulking in their tents, but not much more. Mine own camp is between the rivers, facing the moat and Riverrun's main gates. We've thrown a boom across the Red Fork, downstream of the castle. Manfred Ewe and Reynard Ruttiger have charge of its defence, so no one can escape by boat. I gave them nets as well to fish. It helps keep us fed. Can we starve the castle out? Sir Davin shook his head. The Blackfish expelled all the useless mouths from Riverrun and picked the country clean. He has enough stores to keep man and horse alive for 2 full years. And how well are we provisioned? So long as there are fish in the rivers, we won't starve, though I don't know how we're going to feed the horses. The Freys are hauling food and fodder down from the Twins, but Sir Ryman claims he does not have enough to share, so we must forage for ourselves. Half the men I send off to look for food do not return. Some are deserting, others we find ripening under trees with ropes about their necks. We came on some the day before last, said Jamie. Adam Marbrand's scouts had found them, hanging black-faced beneath a crab-apple tree. The corpses had been stripped naked, and each man had a crab-apple shoved between his teeth. None bore any wounds. Plainly they had yielded. Strongboard had grown furious at that, vowing bloody vengeance on the heads of any men who would truss up warriors to die like suckling pigs. It might have been outlaws, Sir Davin said when Jamie told the tale, or not. There are still bands of Northmen about, and these lords of the Trident may have bent their knees, but methinks their hearts are still wolfish. Jamie glanced at his 2 younger squires who were hovering near the braziers, pretending not to listen. Lewis Piper and Garrett Page were both the sons of Riverlords. He had grown fond of both of them and would hate to have to give them to Sir Ilan. The ropes suggest Dondarrion to me. Your Lightning Lord's not the only man who knows how to tie a noose. Don't get me started on Lord Beric. He's here, he's there, he's everywhere. But when you send men after him, he melts away like dew. The Riverlords are helping him, never doubt it. A bloody marcher lord, if you can believe it. One day, you hear the man is dead. The next, they're saying how he can't be killed. Sir Davin put his wine cup down. My scouts report fires in the high places at night. Signal fires, they think, as if there were a ring of watchers all around us. And there are fires in the villages as well. Some new god. Nope, an old one. Thoros is with Dondarrion, the fat Mirish priest who used to drink with Robert. His golden hand was on the table. Jaime touched it and watched the gold glimmer in the sullen light of the braziers. We'll deal with Dondarrion if we have to, but the blackfish must come first. He has to know his cause is hopeless. Have you tried to treat with him? Sir Raymond did. Rode up to the castle gates, half drunken, blustering, making threats. The blackfish appeared on the ramparts, long enough to say that he would not waste fair words on foul men. Then he put an arrow in the rump of Raymond's palfrey. The horse reared. Frey fell into the mud, and I laughed so hard I almost pissed myself. If it had been me inside the castle, I would have put that arrow through Raymond's lying throat. I'll wear a gorget when I treat with them, said Jaime with a half-smile. I mean to offer him generous terms. If he could end this siege without bloodshed, then it could not be said that he had taken up arms against House Tully. You are welcome to try, my lord, but I doubt that words will win the day. We need to storm the castle. There had been a time not so long ago when Jaime would doubtless have urged the same course. He knew he could not sit here for 2 years to starve the blackfish out. Whatever we do needs to be done quickly, he told Sir Davin. My place is back at King's Landing with the king. Aye, his cousin said. I don't doubt your sister needs you. Why did she send off Kevin? I thought she'd make him hand. He would not take it. He was not as blind as I was. Kevin should be the Warden of the West, or you. It's not that I'm not grateful for the honour, mind you, but our uncle's twice my age and has more experience of command. I hope he knows I never asked for this. He knows. How is Circe? As beautiful as ever? Radiant. Fickle. Golden. False as fool's gold. Last night he dreamed he'd found her fucking moon boy. He'd killed the fool and smashed his sister's teeth to splinters with his golden hand, just as Gregor Clegane had done to poor Pia. In his dreams, Jaime always had two hands. One was made of gold, but it worked just like the other. The sooner we are done with River Run, the sooner I'll be back at Circe's side. What Jaime would do then, he did not know. He talked with his cousin for another hour before the Warden of the West finally took his leave. When he was gone, Jaime donned his gold hand and brown cloak to walk amongst the tents. If truth be told, he liked this life. He felt more comfortable amongst soldiers in the field than he ever had at court, and his men seemed comfortable with him as well. At one cook fire, three crossbowmen offered him a share of hare they'd caught. At another, a young knight asked his counsel on the best way to defend against a warhammer. Down beside the river, he watched two washerwomen jousting in the shallows, mounted on the shoulders of a pair of men-at-arms. The girls were half-drunk and half-naked, laughing and snapping rolled-up cloaks at one another as a dozen other men urged them on. Jaime bet a copper star on the blonde girl riding Raff the Sweetling, and lost it when the two of them went down splashing amongst the reeds. Across the river wolves were howling, and the wind was gusting through a stand of willows, making their branches writhe and whisper. Jaime found Sir Ilan Payne alone outside his tent, honing his greatsword with a whetstone. Come, he said, and the silent knight rose, smiling thinly. He enjoys this, he realized. It pleases him to humiliate me nightly. It might please him even more to kill me. He liked to believe that he was getting better, but the improvement was slow and not without cost. Underneath his steel and wool and boiled leather, Jaime Lannister was a tapestry of cuts and scabs and bruises. A sentry challenged them as they led their horses from the camp. Jaime clapped the man's shoulder with his golden hand. Stay vigilant. There are wolves about. They rode back along the Red Fork to the ruins of a burned village they had passed that afternoon. It was there they danced their midnight dance among blackened stones and old cold cinders. For a little while, Jamie had the better of it. Perhaps his old skill was coming back, he allowed himself to think. Perhaps tonight it would be Payne who went to sleep, bruised and bloody. It was as if Sir Ilyn heard his thoughts. He parried Jamie's last cut lazily and launched a counterattack that drove Jamie back into the river, where his boots slipped out from under him in the mud. He ended on his knees, with the Silent Knight's sword at his throat and his own lost in the reeds. In the moonlight, the pockmarks on Payne's face were large as craters. He made that clacking sound that might have been a laugh, and drew his sword up Jamie's throat till the point came to rest between his lips. Only then did he step back and sheathe his steel. "I would have done better to challenge Raff the Sweetling with a whore upon my back," Jamie thought, as he shook mud off his gilded hand. Part of him wanted to tear the thing off and fling it in the river. It was good for nothing, and the left was not much better. Sir Ilyn had gone back to the horses, leaving him to find his own feet. At least I still have two of those. The last day of their journey was cold and gusty. The wind rattled amongst the branches in the bare brown woods and made the river reeds bow low along the Red Fork. Even mantled in the winter wool of the Kingsguard, Jamie could feel the iron teeth of that wind as he rode beside his cousin Davin. It was late afternoon when they sighted River Run, rising from the narrow point where the Tumblestone joined the Red Fork. The Tully Castle looked like a great stone ship with its prow pointed downriver. Its sandstone walls were drenched in red-gold light and seemed higher and thicker than Jamie had remembered. "This nut will not crack easily," he thought gloomily. If the Blackfish would not listen, he would have no choice but to break the vow he'd made to Catelyn Stark. The vow he'd sworn to his king came first. The boom across the river and the three great camps of the besieging army were just as his cousin had described. Sir Ryman Frey's encampment north of the Tumblestone was the largest and the most disorderly. A great grey gallows loomed above the tents as tall as any trebuchet. On it stood a solitary figure with a rope about his neck. Edmure Tully. Jamie felt a stab of pity. To keep him standing there day after day with that noose around his neck. Better to have his head off and be done with it. Behind the gallows, tents and cook fires spread out in ragged disarray. The Frey lordlings and their knights had raised their pavilions comfortably upstream of the latrine trenches. Downstream were muddy hovels, wains, and ox carts. Sir Ryman don't want his boys getting bored, so he gives them whores and cockfights and boar baiting, Sir Davin said. He's even got himself a bloody singer. Our aunt brought White Smile Watt from Lannisport, if you can believe it. Sir Ryman had to have a singer too. Couldn't we just dam the river and drown the whole lot of them, cuz? Jamie could see archers moving behind the merlons on the castle ramparts. Above them streamed the banners of House Tully, the silver trout defiant on its striped field of red and blue. But the highest tower flew a different flag, a long white standard emblazoned with the dire wolf of Stark. "The first time I saw River Run, I was a squire green as summer grass," Jamie told his cousin. "Old Sumner Crakehall sent me to deliver a message, one he swore could not be entrusted to a raven. Lord Hoster kept me for a fortnight whilst mulling his reply, and sat me beside his daughter Lysa at every meal. Small wonder you took the white. I'd have done the same." Oh, Lysa was not so fearsome as all that. She had been a pretty girl, in truth, dimpled and delicate with long auburn hair. Timid, though, prone to tongue-tied silences and fits of giggles with none of Circe's fire. Her older sister had seemed more interesting, though Catelyn was promised to some northern boy, the heir of Winterfell. But at that age, no girl interested Jamie half so much as Hoster's famous brother, who had won renown fighting the Ninepenny Kings upon the Stepstones. At table he had ignored poor Lysa, whilst pressing Brynden Tully for tales of Maelys the Monstrous and the Ebon Prince. "Sir Brynden was younger then than I am now," Jamie reflected, "and I was younger than Peck." The nearest ford across the Red Fork was upstream of the castle. To reach Sir Davin's camp, they had to ride through Emon Frey's, past the pavilions of the Riverlords, who had bent their knees and been accepted back into the King's peace. Jamie noted the banners of Leicester and Vance, of Root and Goodbrook, the acorns of House Smallford and Lord Piper's Dancing Maiden. But the banners he did not see gave him pause. The silver eagle of Malister was nowhere in evidence, nor the red horse of Bracken, the willow of the Rigers, the twining snakes of Page. Though all had renewed their fealty to the Iron Throne, none had come to join the siege. The Brackens were fighting the Blackwoods, Jamie knew, which accounted for their absence. But as for the rest... "Our new friends are no friends at all. Their loyalty goes no deeper than their skins. River Run had to be taken, and soon. The longer the siege dragged on, the more it would hearten other recalcitrants like Titus Blackwood. At the ford, Sir Kenneth of Case blew the horn of Herrick. That should bring the Blackfish to the battlements. Sir Hugo and Sir Dermot led Jamie's way across the river, splashing through the muddy red-brown waters with the white standard of the Kingsguard and Tommen's Stag and Lion streaming in the wind. The rest of the column followed hard behind them. The Lannister camp rang to the sound of wooden hammers where a new siege tower was rising. Two other towers stood completed, half-covered with raw horsehide. Between them sat a rolling ram, a tree trunk with a fire-hardened point suspended on chains beneath a wooden roof. "My cuz has not been idle, it would seem." "My lord," Peck said, "where do you want your tent?" "There, upon that rise." He pointed with his golden hand, though it was not well suited to that task. "Baggage there, horse lines there. We'll use the latrines my cousin has so kindly dug for us. Sir Adam, inspect our perimeter with an eye for any weaknesses." Jamie did not anticipate an attack, but he had not anticipated the Whispering Wood either. "Shall I summon the stoats for a war council?" Davin asked. "Not until I've spoken to the Blackfish." Jamie beckoned to beardless John Betley. "Shake out a peace banner and bear a message to the castle. Inform Sir Brynden Tully that I would have words with him at first light on the morrow. I will come to the edge of the moat and meet him on his drawbridge." Peck looked alarmed. "My lord, the bowmen could..." "They won't." Jamie dismounted. "Raise my tent and plant my standards, and we'll see who comes running and how quickly." It did not require long. Pia was fussing at a brazier, trying to light the coals. Peck went to help her. Of late, Jamie oft went to sleep to the sound of them fucking in a corner of the tent. As Garrett was undoing the clasps on Jamie's greaves, the tent flapped open. "Here at last are you," boomed his aunt. She filled the door, with her fray husband peering out from behind her. "Past time! Have you no hug for your old fat aunt?" She held out her arms and left him no choice but to embrace her. Jenna Lannister had been a shapely woman in her youth, always threatening to overflow her bodice. Now the only shape she had was square. Her face was broad and smooth, her neck a thick pink pillar, her bosom enormous. She carried enough flesh to make two of her husband. Jamie hugged her dutifully and waited for her to pinch his ear. She had been pinching his ear for as long as he could remember, but today she forbore. Instead, she planted soft and sloppy kisses on his cheeks. "I am sorry for your loss." "I had a new hand made of gold," he showed her. "Very nice. Will they make you a gold father, too?" Lady Jenna's voice was sharp. "Tywin was the loss I meant. A man such as Tywin Lannister comes but once in 1,000 years, declared her husband. Emmon Frey was a fretful man with nervous hands. He might have weighed 10 stone, but only wet and clad in mail. He was a weed in wool, with no chin to speak of, a flaw that the prominence of the apple in his throat made even more absurd. Half his hair had been gone before he turned 30. Now he was 60, and only a few white wisps remained. "Some queer tales have been reaching us of late," Lady Jenna said, after Jamie dismissed Pia and his squires. "A woman hardly knows what to believe. Can it be true that Tyrion slew Tywin? Or is that some calumny your sister put about?" "It's true enough." The weight of his golden hand had grown irksome. He fumbled at the straps that secured it to his wrist. "For a son
to raise his hand against a father, Sir Emon said. Monstrous! These are dark days in Westeros. I fear for us all with Lord Tywin gone.
You feared for us all when he was here. Jenna settled her ample rump upon a camp stool, which creaked alarmingly beneath her weight.
Nephew, speak to us of our son Cleos and the manner of his death.
Jaime undid the last fastening and set his hand aside. We were set upon by outlaws. Sir Cleos scattered them, but it cost his life. The lie came easy. He could see that it pleased them.
The boy had courage. I always said so. It was in his blood.
A pinkish froth glistened on Sir Emon's lips when he spoke, courtesy of the sour leaf he liked to chew.
His bones should be interred beneath a rock in the Hall of Heroes, Lady Jenna declared. Where was he laid to rest?
Nowhere. The bloody mummers stripped his corpse and left his flesh to feast the carrion crows.
Beside a stream, he lied.
When this war is done, I will find the place and send him home. Bones were bones these days. Nothing was easier to come by.
This war, Lord Emon cleared his throat, the apple in his throat moving up and down. You will have seen the siege machines, rams, trebuchets, towers. It will not serve, Jaime. Daven means to break my walls, smash in my gates. He talks of burning pitch, of setting the castle afire. My castle.
He reached up one sleeve, brought out a parchment, and thrust it at Jaime's face.
I have the decree, signed by the king, by Tommen, see, the royal seal, the stag and lion. I am the lawful lord of Riverrun, and I will not have it reduced to a smoking ruin.
Oh, put that fool thing away, his wife snapped. So long as the blackfish sits inside Riverrun, you can wipe your ass with that paper for all the good it does us. Though she had been a Frey for 50 years, Lady Jenna remained very much a Lannister.
Quite a lot of Lannister. Jaime will deliver you the castle.
To be sure, Lord Emon said.
Sir Jaime, your lord father's faith in me was well placed, you shall see. I mean to be firm but fair with my new vassals. Blackwood and Bracken, Jason Malister, Vance and Piper, they shall learn that they have a just overlord in Emon Frey. My father as well, yes. He is the lord of the crossing, but I am the lord of Riverrun. A son has a duty to obey his father, true, but a bannerman must obey his overlord.
Oh, gods be good.
You are not his overlord, sir. Read your parchment. You were granted Riverrun with its lands and incomes.
No more. Peter Baelish is the Lord Paramount of the Trident. Riverrun will be subject to the rule of Harrenhal.
That did not please Lord Emon.
Harrenhal is a ruin, haunted and accursed, he objected. And Baelish? The man is a coin, counter, no proper lord, his birth.
If you are unhappy with the arrangements, go to King's Landing and take it up with my sweet sister.
Circe would devour Emon Frey and pick her teeth with his bones, he did not doubt. That is, if she's not too busy fucking Osmond Kettleblack.
Lady Jenna gave a snort.
There is no need to trouble her grace with such nonsense.
Em, why don't you step outside and have a breath of air?
A breath of air? Or a good long piss, if you prefer. My nephew and I have family matters to discuss.
Lord Emon flushed.
Yes, it is warm in here. I will wait outside, my lady.
Sir? His lordship rolled up his parchment, sketched a bow toward Jaime, and tottered from the tent.
It was hard not to feel contemptuous of Emon Frey. He had arrived at Casterly Rock in his 14th year to wed a lioness half his age. Tyrion used to say that Lord Tywin had given him a nervous belly for a wedding gift.
Jenna has played her part as well.
Jaime remembered many a feast where Emon sat poking at his food sullenly whilst his wife made ribald jests with whatever household knight had been seated to her left, their conversation punctuated by loud bursts of laughter. She gave Frey 4 sons, to be sure. At least she says they are his. No one in Casterly Rock had the courage to suggest otherwise, least of all Sir Emon.
No sooner was he gone than his lady wife rolled her eyes. My lord and master, what was your father thinking to name him Lord of Riverrun?
I imagine he was thinking of your sons.
I think of them as well.
M will make a wretched lord. Ty may do better, if he has the sense to learn from me and not his father. She looked about the tent. Do you have wine? Jamie found a flagon and poured for her one-handed. Why are you here, my lady? You should have remained at Casterly Rock until the fighting's done. Once M heard he was a lord, he had to come at once to claim his seat. Lady Jenna took a drink and wiped her mouth on her sleeve. Your father should have granted us Darry. Cleos married one of the ploughman's daughters, you will recall. His grieving widow is furious that her sons were not granted her lord father's lands. Gatehouse Army is Darry only on her mother's side. My good daughter Jane is her aunt, a full sister to Lady Maria. A younger sister, Jamie reminded her, and Ty will have River Run, a greater prize than Darry. A poisoned prize. House Darry is extinguished in the male line, House Tully is not. That muttonhead Sir Ryman puts a noose round Edmure's neck but will not hang him, and Rosalind Frey has a trout growing in her belly. My grandsons will never be secure in River Run so long as any Tully heir remains alive. She was not wrong, Jamie knew. If Rosalind has a girl, she can wed Ty, provided old Lord Walder will consent. Yes, I've thought of that, and a boy is just as likely, though, and his little cock would cloud the issue. And if Sir Brynden should survive this siege, he might be inclined to claim River Run in his own name, or in the name of young Robert Arryn. Jamie remembered little Robert from King's Landing, still sucking on his mother's teats at 4. Arryn won't live long enough to breed. And why should the Lord of the Eyrie need River Run? Why does a man with one pot of gold need another? Men are greedy. Tywin should have granted River Run to Kevin and Darry to M. I would have told him so if he had troubled to ask me. But when did your father ever consult with anyone but Kevin? She sighed deeply. I do not blame Kevin for wanting the safer seat for his own boy, mind you. I know him too well. What Kevin wants and what Lancel wants appear to be two different things. He told her of Lancel's decision to renounce his wife and lands and lordship to fight for the holy faith. If you still want Darry, write to Circe and make your case. Lady Jenna waved her cup in dismissal. No, that horse has left the yard. M has it in his pointed head that he will rule the Riverlands. And Lancel, I suppose we should have seen this coming from afar. A life protecting the High Septon is not so different from a life protecting the king, after all. Kevin will be wroth, I fear, as wroth as Tywin was when you got it in your head to take the fight. At least Kevin still has Martin for an heir. He can marry him to Gatehouse Army in Lancel's place. 7 save us all. His aunt gave a sigh, and speaking of the 7, why would Circe permit the faith to arm again? Jamie shrugged. I am certain she had reasons. Reasons? Lady Jenna made a rude noise. They had best be good reasons. The swords and stars troubled even the Targaryens. The Conqueror himself tread carefully with the faith, so they would not oppose him. And when Aegon died and the lords rose up against his sons, both orders were in the thick of that rebellion. The more pious lords supported them, and many of the small folk. King Maegor finally had to put a bounty on them. He paid a dragon for the head of any unrepentant warrior's son, and a silver stag for the scalp of a poor fellow, if I recall my history. Thousands were slain, but nigh as many still roamed the realm defiant, until the Iron Throne slew Maegor, and King Jaehaerys agreed to pardon all those who would set aside their swords. I had forgotten most of that, Jamie confessed. You and your sister both. She took another swallow of her wine. Is it true that Tywin was smiling on his beer? He was rotting on his beer. It made his mouth twist. Was that all it was? That seemed to sadden her. Men say that Tywin never smiled, but he smiled when he wed your mother and when Aerys made him hand. When Tarbeck Hall came crashing down on Lady Ellen, that scheming bitch. Tige claimed he smiled then. And he smiled at your birth, Jamie. I saw that with my own eyes. You and Circe, pink and perfect, as alike as two peas in a pod. Well, except between the legs. What lungs you had!
Hear us roar, Jamie grinned. Next you'll be telling me how much you'd like to laugh.
No. Tywin mistrusted laughter. He heard too many people laughing at your grandsire.
She frowned. I promise you, this mama's farce of a siege would not have amused him.
How do you mean to end it, now that you're here?
Treat with the blackfish. That won't work. I mean to offer him good terms.
Terms require trust. The phrase murdered guests beneath their roof, and you,
well, I mean no offence, my love, but you did kill a certain king you had sworn to protect. And I'll kill the blackfish if he does not yield. His tone was harsher than he'd intended, but he was in no mood for having Aerys Targaryen thrown in his face.
How? With your tongue?
Her voice was scornful. I may be an old fat woman, but I do not have cheese between my ears, Jamie. Neither does the blackfish. Empty threats won't daunt him.
What would you counsel?
She gave a ponderous shrug.
M wants Edmure's head off.
For once he may be right. Sir Ryman has made us a laughingstock with that gibbet of his.
You need to show Sir Brynden that your threats have teeth.
Killing Edmure might harden Sir Brynden's resolve. Resolve is one thing Brynden Blackfish never lacked for.
Hoster Tully could have told you that.
Lady Jenna finished her wine.
Well, I would never presume to tell you how to fight a war. I know my place. Unlike your sister. Is it true that Cersei burned the Red Keep?
Only the Tower of the Hand. His aunt rolled her eyes. She would have done better to leave the tower and burn her hand.
Harry Swift!
If ever a man deserved his arms, it is Sir Harry's. And Giles Rosby, Seven, save us! I thought he died years ago. Merryweather, your father used to call his grandsire the Chuckler, I'll have you know. Tywin claimed the only thing Merryweather was good for was chuckling at the king's witticisms. His lordship chuckled himself right into exile, as I recall. Cersei has put some bastard on the council, too, and a kettle in the king's guard. She has the Faith arming and the Bravosi calling in loans all over Westeros, none of which would be happening if she'd had the simple sense to make your uncle the king's hand. Sir Kevin refused the office.
So he said. He did not say why.
There was much he did not say. Would not say. Lady Jenna made a face.
Kevin always did what was asked of him. It is not like him to turn away from any duty.
Something is awry here. I can smell it. He said that he was tired. He knows, Cersei had said, as they stood above their father's corpse. He knows about us.
Tired?
His aunt pursed her lips. I suppose he has a right to be. It has been hard for Kevin, living all his life in Tywin's shadow. It was hard for all my brothers. That shadow Tywin cast was long and black, and each of them had to struggle to find a little son. Tygert tried to be his own man, but he could never match your father, and that just made him angrier as the years went by.
Geryon made japes, better to mock the game than to play and lose. But Kevin saw how things stood early on, so he made himself a place by your father's side.
And you? Jamie asked her.
It was not a game for girls. I was my father's precious princess, and Tywin's too, until I disappointed him. My brother never learned to like the taste of disappointment.
She pushed herself to her feet.
I've said what I came to say. I shan't take any more of your time. Do what Tywin would have done.
Did you love him? Jamie heard himself ask. His aunt looked at him strangely.
I was 7 when Walder Frey persuaded my lord father to give my hand to M, his second son, not even his heir. Father was himself a 3rd-born son, and younger children crave the approval of their elders. Frey sensed that weakness in him, and father agreed for no better reason than to please him. My betrothal was announced at a feast with half the West in attendance. Ellen Tarbeck laughed, and the Red Lion went angry from the hall. The rest sat on their tongues. Only Tywin dared speak against the match. A boy of 10. Father turned as white as mare's milk, and Walder Frey was quivering. She smiled. How could I not love him after that? That is not to say that I approved of all he did or much enjoyed the company of the man that he became. But every little girl needs a big brother to protect her. Tywin was big, even when he was little. She gave a sigh. Who will protect us now? Jaime kissed her cheek. He left a son. Aye, he did. That is what I fear the most, in truth. That was a queer remark. Why should you fear? Jaime, she said, tugging on his ear, sweetling, I have known you since you were a babe at Joanna's breast. You smile like Geryon and fight like Tig, and there's some of Kevin in you, else you would not wear that cloak. But Tyrion is Tywin's son, not you. I said so once to your father's face, and he would not speak to me for half a year. Men are such thundering great fools, even the sort who come along once in a thousand years.
Samwell. Up in the loft, a woman was giving birth noisily, while below a man lay dying by the fire. Samwell Tarly could not say which frightened him more. They covered poor Bannon with a pile of furs and stoked the fire high, yet all he could say was, I'm cold, oh, please, I'm so cold. Sam was trying to feed him onion broth, but he could not swallow. The broth dribbled over his lips and down his chin as fast as Sam could spoon it in.
That one's dead.
Craster eyed the man with indifference as he worried at a sausage.
Be kinder to stick a knife in his chest than that spoon down his throat, he asked me.
I don't recall as we did. Giant was no more than 5 feet tall. His true name was Bedwick, but a fierce little man for all that. Slayer, did you ask Craster for his counsel? Sam cringed at the name, but shook his head. He filled another spoon, brought it to Bannon's mouth, and tried to ease it between his lips.
Food and fire, Giant was saying. That was all we asked of you, and you grudge us the food. Be glad I didn't grudge you fire, too.
Craster was a thick man, made thicker by the ragged, smelly sheepskins he wore day and night. He had a broad, flat nose, a mouth that drooped to one side, and a missing ear. And though his matted hair and tangled beard might be grey going white, his hard, knuckly hands still looked strong enough to hurt.
I fed you what I could, but you crows were always hungry. I'm a godly man, else I would have chased you off. You think I like the likes of him dying on my floor? You think I need all your mouths, little man?
The wildling spat.
Crows, when did a blackbird ever bring good to a man's all, I ask you? Never. Never.
More broth ran from the corner of Bannon's mouth. Sam dabbed it away with the corner of his sleeve. The ranger's eyes were open but unseeing.
I'm cold, he said again, so faintly.
A maester might have known how to save him, but they had no maester. Kedge Whiteye had taken Bannon's mangled foot off 9 days past, in a gout of pus and blood that made Sam sick. But it was too little, too late.
I'm so cold,
the pale lips repeated. About the hall, a ragged score of black brothers squatted on the floor or sat on rough-hewn benches, drinking cups of the same thin onion broth and gnawing on chunks of hard bread. A couple were wounded worse than Bannon, to look at them. Fornio had been delirious for days, and Sir Byam's shoulder was oozing a foul yellow pus. When they'd left Castle Black, Brown Bernard had been carrying bags of Moorish fire, mustard salve, ground garlic, tansy, poppy, king's copper, and other healing herbs. Even sweet sleep, which gave the gift of painless death. But Brown Bernard had died on the fist, and no one had thought to search for Maester Aemon's medicines. Hake had known some herb lore as well, being a cook, but Hake was also lost. So it was left to the surviving stewards to do what they could for the wounded, which was little enough.
At least they are dry here, with a fire to warm them. They need more food, though.
They all needed more food. The men had been grumbling for days, Clubfoot Carl kept saying how Craster had to have a hidden larder, and Garth of Oldtown had begun to echo him when he was out of the Lord Commander's hearing. Sam had thought of begging for something more nourishing for the wounded men at least, but he did not have the courage. Craster's eyes were cold and mean, and whenever the wildling looked his way, his hands twitched a little, as if they wanted to curl up into fists.
"Does he know I spoke to Gilly the last time we were here?"
he wondered.
"Did she tell him I said we'd take her? Did he beat it out of her?"
"I'm cold," said Bannon. "Please, I'm cold."
For all the heat and smoke in Craster's hall, Sam felt cold himself.
"I'm tired, so tired."
He needed sleep, but whenever he closed his eyes, he dreamed of blowing snow and dead men shambling toward him with black hands and bright blue eyes. Up in the loft, Gilly let out a shuddering sob that echoed down the long, low, windowless hall. "Push!" he heard one of Craster's older wives tell her.
"Harder! Harder! Scream if it helps!"
She did, so loud it made Sam wince. Craster turned his head to glare.
"I've had a bellyful of that shrieking," he shouted up. "Give her a rag to bite down on, or I'll come up there and give her a taste of my hand."
He would too, Sam knew. Craster had 19 wives, but none who dared interfere once he started up that ladder. No more than the Black Brothers had 2 nights past, when he was beating one of the younger girls. There had been mutterings, to be sure.
"He's killing her,"
Garth of Greenaway had said, and Clubfoot Carl laughed and said,
"If he don't want the little sweetmeat, he should give her to me."
Black Bernard cursed a low, angry voice, and Alan of Rosby got up and went outside so he wouldn't have to hear. "His roof, his rule," the ranger, Ronald Harclay, had reminded them. "Craster's a friend to the watch."
A friend,
Sam thought, as he listened to Gilly's muffled shrieks. Craster was a brutal man who ruled his wives and daughters with an iron hand, but his keep was a refuge all the same.
"Frozen crows,"
Craster sneered, when they straggled in, those few who had survived the snow, the whites, and the bitter cold.
"Are not so big a flock as went north, neither."
Yet he had given them space on his floor, a roof to keep the snow off, a fire to dry them out, and his wives had brought them cups of hot wine to put some warmth in their bellies.
"Bloody crows,"
he called them, but he fed them too, meager though the fare might be.
"We are his guests," Sam reminded himself. "Gilly is his daughter, his wife, his roof, his rule."
The first time he'd seen Craster's keep, Gilly had come begging for help, and Sam had lent her his black cloak to conceal her belly when she went to find Jon Snow.
"Knights are supposed to defend women and children."
Only a few of the Black Brothers were knights, but even so,
"we all say the words," Sam thought. "I am the shield that guards the realms of men."
A woman was a woman, even a wildling woman.
"We should help her, we should."
It was her child Gilly feared for. She was frightened that it might be a boy. Craster raised up his daughters to be his wives, but there were neither men nor boys to be seen about his compound. Gilly had told John that Craster gave his sons to the gods.
"If the gods are good, they will send her a daughter," Sam prayed.
Up in the loft, Gilly choked back a scream.
"That's it," a woman said. "Another push now. Oh, I see his head."
"Hers," Sam thought miserably. "Her head, hers." "Cold," said Bannon weakly. "Please, I'm so cold."
Sam put the bowl and spoon aside, tossed another fur across the dying man, put another stick on the fire. Gilly gave a shriek and began to pant. Craster gnawed on his hard black sausage. He had sausages for himself and his wives, he said, but none for the watch.
"Women,"
he complained,
"the way they wail. I had me a fat shell once burst a litter of eight with no more than a grunt.
Chewing, he turned his head to squint contemptuously at Sam.
She was near as fat as you, boy, slayer.